that drenched him instantly as it clattered across the metal floor and began pooling around his feet and ankles. From where he sat, Maul looked up at the pipe with annoyance, but no real sense of surprise. Rising to his full height, he jerked on the zip ties that fastened him to the bench, already knowing that they wouldn't yield. He grabbed the bench and yanked. The steel posts weren't going anywhere either, nor had he expected them to. For the moment, this seemed to be where he was fighting from. The water had risen past his knees and was coming up to his waist. The entire ceiling seemed to be pouring down on him, and the acoustics of the room had begun to change, obliterating the echoes and leaving only a steady, discordant roar. It was happening so fast that it felt less like the water was coming down and more like he was sinking into it. He could feel the sheer weight of liquid tonnage itself pressing in around him, rising to engulf his chest and shoulders, and then creeping up higher around his neck. Tipping back his head, he exhaled and watched his breath plume out in a visible cloud. The temperature in the cell had dropped 20 degrees in 2 minutes. He felt both his hearts quickening, pumping blood to his extremities, readying himself for whatever came next. Where was Rook? Was he coming? Or had IzSmash failed to hack the algorithm as he'd requested? He gave another glance at what remained of his surroundings. The cell had grown darker, as if the lights themselves had been swallowed up by the flood. Drawing in deep breaths, saturating his lungs with as much oxygen as he could, Maul plunged his head under the surface, acclimating his vision to the turbid murkiness below. At first he saw nothing. Light shone faintly from the submerged walls, hazy in the depths. He could see nothing else down there. Not yet. He burst to the surface again, as high as the restraints would allow him to rise. The water was almost above his head, leaving only a narrow, cramped layer of stale oxygen above the surface. He went down again, and when he lifted his head, the water level had risen to the ceiling. There was a centimeter or two of air at the very top. Maul sucked at it, feeling it disappear against his lips. Across the cell he felt the low, grinding reverberation of a hatch sliding open underwater. He pulled himself down but saw nothing. An instant later, below the surface, something brushed against his leg. Squinting into the depths, Maul made out a pair of bulbous, glassy, black eyes staring back at him. An instant later, it struck. Spectators. Siddiqui was in her office watching the live holo of the underwater match when her brother burst in behind her.
"Good," she said. "You're just in time. It's starting now. Take a seat."
Dakarai didn't move. He stood over her, his pale face mottled with high splotches of red in his cheeks and forehead. In his silence, his indignation was all the more apparent. It seemed to ripple off his skin in nearly visible waves.
"What's wrong?"
But of course she already knew. They had been through all this before. In the final weeks before Coghive 7 became fully operational, when Dakarai had realized how much of his original design was going to have to be jettisoned in order for them to move forward, he'd become sulky and remote, withdrawing even more thoroughly from her, disappearing for days at a time. His silence had taken on an almost palpable weight. Only by promising him absolute autonomy when it came to the algorithm and the bouts had Siddiqui been able to placate him. And now she had violated that rule as well.
"I can see that you're upset."
Siddiqui rose to her feet with a sigh.
"Forgive me. I know this particular match isn't what your algorithm called for. But Dakarai, you have to trust me on this. The Zabrak is becoming a real problem for us. He needs to be broken. And this fight?
He thrust a thin sheaf of flimsy plast in her face. Siddiqui took it from him and glanced down at it. It was a printout of the algorithm's actual match, which was supposed to have pitted two completely different inmates against one another.
I know, Siddiqui said, but I'm telling you.
Warden!
Siddiqui turned and glanced at the holoscreen that had gone active above her head. Gaming Commissioner Dragomir Cloris's face glared down at her, inflamed with fury.
Commissioner, Siddiqui said, I'm beginning to think your position doesn't keep you busy enough.
Siddiqui, what do you think you're doing?
Matching my reigning champion, as you can see.
The bout that you posted indicates a completely different set of opponents. The odds that you gave on this fight have nothing to do with the Zabrak or the Aqualish. Which means that you either deliberately chose to defy the Gaming Commission regulations.
He paused.
Or you've been hacked.
Hacked? Siddiqui chuckled. Commissioner, I assure you.
Do you see a third explanation?
Please. She glanced at Dakarai, as if he might somehow, in defiance of everything she knew about him, speak up on her behalf. If you'll just allow me to investigate.
It's too late for that. You've overstepped your bounds for the last time.
There was a portentous silence as Cloris summoned the full weight of his authority.
The Galactic Gaming Commission is shutting you down.
What?
You heard me.
You...
Siddiqui's face didn't change, but her neck flushed red, the color rising slowly to her hairline.
You really don't want to start down that road with me, Dragomir.
If you're implying that I don't have the authority, then you're sadly mistaken. If you think I'm bluffing, then you're wrong about that too. And if I were you, I would keep all your inmates in lockdown until this is sorted out.
Now you're telling me how to run my prison?
Cloris glared at her.
You should be thanking me. You have far bigger problems. And if you'd made the slightest effort to listen to me earlier, none of this would have reached the crisis point.
I'm telling you, the Hutts haven't shown the faintest interest in...
The Dasiljik clan has already infiltrated your prison.
Excuse me?
According to intelligence that I've just received, they've had their foot soldiers inside Coghive 7 for months in an ongoing effort to ferret out Radik. It's uncertain how many exactly, but the data that have come across my desk so far seem to indicate that their presence within the prison is significant.
You're the Gaming Commissioner. How is this your business?
Let's just say you need someone to watch over you.
Cloris sighed.
I know your tendency to get in over your head.
Siddiqui allowed herself a slow, restorative breath. In all the years she'd been here, this was as close as Cloris had come to acknowledging the brief relationship that they'd enjoyed during her early years managing the sabacc tables at the Outlander Casino and Resort on Coruscant. She'd been very young at the time, new to her position, easily swayed and even seduced by his authority. What happened between them had ended badly, with misgivings on both sides. But now was not the time or place to exhume that particular corpse and find out whether there was any life left in it. She forced a smile. It felt like work.
Dragomir, that's very kind. Under normal circumstances, I'd be flattered. But...
Stop. Just stop.
Cloris paused, and when he spoke again, he sounded more concerned than she'd ever heard him.
Siddiqui, I've heard all your excuses and prevarications. But at this point, if you do know anything at all about the whereabouts of this man Radik, I recommend that you share it with the Hutt straight away. Otherwise, you may have a mutiny on your hands that even you cannot control.
Mutiny? You mean a riot? Siddiqui glanced over her shoulder at Dakarai, but her brother remained expressionless, his face maddeningly unreadable. She turned back to the holoscreen. All our inmates carry electrostatic charges implanted in their hearts. I can terminate any of them with the touch of a button. If any of them were foot soldiers sent in here by the Hutts...
Siddiqui, I'm not talking about inmates. I'm talking about guards.
She just stared at him. I beg your pardon?
How many guards does Coghive 7 employ at any given time?
Between 70 and 80. But we screen each one carefully with a full background check and identity verification.
All of which the Dasilaje clan could have easily forged in order to get their people inside.
The commissioner said. His voice was grave.
Be vigilant, Siddiqui. I'll speak to you again soon.
Siddiqui turned back to look at Dakarai again. But her brother was no longer looking at the commissioner. He was watching the match.
Tank.
Maul's lungs were screaming. He'd already lost track of how long he'd been underwater. Time had twisted back upon itself and lost all meaning. Both his hearts were thudding faster, pounding through his entire body in an attempt to circulate any remaining air. Blackness crowded in around the edges of his vision, threatening to bury his consciousness beneath an avalanche of oxygen debt. When the other inmate had first swum at him, he had slammed Maul in the diaphragm, driving out the breath he'd inhaled just before going down for the last time. Maul swirled around, pulling himself down by the zip ties that fastened his ankles, coiling down alongside the submerged bench. What he saw was an aqualish swimming back toward him, cutting smoothly through the water. The one Maul hoped was Rook. He sprang up and plunged his fingers into the other inmate's bulbous eyes. The aqualish recoiled and disappeared, only to come at him again from behind with a violent strike to the back of his skull. Maul sucked in a mouthful of contaminated water and gagged, expelling it in an involuntary contraction. Around him in the near darkness, nothing stirred. A thin sediment of silt and filth seemed to have settled across the bottom. His gaze settled on the blurry glow of lights from the other side of the cell, and he became aware of how little time he had left. He looked down at the bench to which his ankles were still fastened. The pressure seemed to be squeezing his chest like an enormous fist. If he weren't bound here, if he just had one more breath of air...
Stop it!
It was his master's voice, unmistakable in its scorn.
Your inadequacy is worse than disgraceful. It's nauseating.
Maul steeled himself. The cold words sobered him. If he was destined to die here, even under these humiliating circumstances, if such was the fate that the dark side had selected for him, then it would not be with the whimpering of his own weakness in his ears. Yanking himself down to the very floor of the cell, he flattened his body beneath the bench, groping in darkness until his numb fingertips located the rounded shape of one of the bolts holding the steel plating together. There were several such bolts, but this one felt like the loosest. Raising an elbow, he drove it down against the bolt, then lifted it up and hit the metal again until the screw loosened enough that he was able to twist it loose and pluck it free. Putting his mouth to the newly exposed hole, he sucked in fresh air and blew out bubbles through his nose
before drawing in another deep breath, letting the oxygen replenish his bloodstream. The results were immediate. The blackness around his vision began to fade. Yet he made himself wait here beneath the bench for another moment, until he saw the vague shape of the aqualish swimming just above him. Maul shot up through the water as far as the ankle restraints would allow and seized the other inmate by its tusks, snapping one of them off. The aqualish trumpeted out a nasal shriek of surprise and pain, and Maul hammered him in the abdomen. When his opponent bent forward, he pounded Rook's skull into the cell wall. Blood seeped from the aqualish's head as he rounded on Maul, cutting back through the water. Gone again. Maul squinted, scanning the depths. Where had the other inmate taken himself? Had the hatchway been left open so that Rook could come and go, attacking him at his leisure? He pulled himself back down under the bench, pressed his lips to the hole in the floor, and was about to inhale another breath when he felt something thick and slippery and hideously alive squirt up inside his mouth. Recoiling, Maul spat it out and saw a thin white worm floating up past his face, wiggling defiantly, its tiny mandibles working fiercely to grip hold of something. He narrowed his eyes and looked back down at the hole. More of the things were beginning to push their way up into the cell through the hole, pulsing up from below in a steady stream. Maul turned away. Was there any manner of foulness that this place did not specialize in? How much longer? White-hot pressure exploded against the back of his skull, leaving him dizzy and disoriented. In his peripheral vision, he was narrowly aware of the aqualish coming back around, his body rippling effortlessly toward him, cocking back its fist again to deliver another blow. Maul fought to anchor his thoughts. With his supply of air shut down, he knew he had to finish this now. Slimy to touch, greasy to feel, but mix me with blood, and I'll eat through steel. He stuck one hand down under the bench, scraping his fingers against the thick accumulation of sticky reddish-brown gunk that had made a home for itself in the seams between the metal plates. Cupping the stuff in one palm, kneading it together, he held still and waited. He had one chance to get this right. He knew he would not have to wait long. The opponent made his move. As he darted toward Maul, Maul grabbed him by the tufts of hair on either side of his face and shoved the handful of toxic girder mold into the open laceration in the aqualish's scalp, grinding it as deeply into the wound as he could. The results were even more gratifying than he'd hoped. The aqualish recoiled and began to scream, bubbles flooding out of him as he clutched at his head with both hands. The wound was already sizzling and bubbling, flecks of tissue drifting away. Maul seized his head and locked his arm around the aqualish's neck. Grabbing another handful of girder mold from under the bench, Maul reached down and smeared it into the zip ties that bound him there. Then he pulled the aqualish down so that the blood from his wound churned through the water to interact with the mold. The resulting catalyst attacked the nylosteel instantly, cutting through it. All at once, Maul's legs were suddenly, shockingly, free. Kicking loose, turning around in the water, Maul dragged the other inmate down head first toward the submerged floor of the cell and held him there, watching the steel plating dissolving beneath it. A ragged hole had already begun to open, widening while he watched, water siphoning down through it. Within seconds, it would be sufficient for what he required. He and the aqualish were sucked down together, pushed through on the current, Maul holding tight to his neck. A moment later, they spilled out into an open drainage shaft. The pipe opened below them, and Maul threw the aqualish up onto the platform overhead and sprang up alongside him into the open air. He whooped in a deep breath of air, filling his lungs, and turned to fix the other inmate with his gaze.
Are you Rook?
The Aqualish nodded and barked out a froggy croaking,
Yes!
You know what this is?
Maul asked, still holding on to a handful of the girder mold that he'd brought from the cell.
And what it can do to you when it interacts with your blood?
The Aqualish faced him. His face was horribly disfigured from the acid, his eyes badly wounded from the puncture attack. But beneath the physical trauma, there was no mistaking the disbelief in his expression.
This can't be happening. I'm not supposed to be matched, ever. He said I was never going to have to fight.
You're going to die,
Maul told him.
Right now. Slowly. I'll burn the rest of your face off. Unless you tell me everything.
I don't know what you're...
About Iram Radik.
The one called Rook made a poor show of not understanding, but it didn't last long. Maul held the mold up to the bleeding head wound, in close enough proximity that the inmate's flesh actually began, faintly, to sizzle. The Aqualish tried to jerk back, but Maul held him fast. When he spoke, the words came out in a scream.
What do you want to know?
How do I get to him?
You can't! Nobody can! Even I don't speak to him directly!
You're lying.
I'm not! I swear!
Then you're worthless to me,
Maul said, and prepared to smear the rest of the mold over Rook's face.
Wait! Wait! I can tell you this!
The Aqualish panted, his gills flapping as he tried vainly to salvage what remained of his composure.
The weapons! They arrive in different pieces!
I already know that,
Maul said.
What happens after the gang members smuggle them in? Where do they go? How does Radik retrieve the pieces from them without being seen?
The birds!
Rook said.
They collect the different components. Bring them to the shop. If you follow the Clawbirds, you'll find Radik.
When does the next shipment arrive?
There's a supply ship docking tomorrow, during the first watch. But that's truly all I know.
Is there anyone else between you and Radik? Another link in the chain?
Gaping at him, his wounded eyes darting back to the handful of mold packed into Maul's fist, the Aqualish murmured some oath in its own native language.
Please, I cooperated. I told you everything.
Answer me,
Maul said.
Who else is there?
Rook's three-fingered right hand swept out, smearing something on the wet surface of the pipe. Maul looked at it. It was a circle.
What does that mean?
He growled. The Aqualish made a wet, shuddering noise.
It's all I know. Don't kill me. Don't.
You were dead when you were matched with me,
Maul said.
But I will give my word to you. It will be quick.
He took hold of Rook's head with both hands and cracked the thing's neck in a single, instantaneous jerk. The Aqualish shuddered and fell motionless, slipping backward and toppling from view.
Clarity.
Midnight. The morgue. Maul had found his way down here after the last fight.
No one had tried to engage him along the way. Something had changed in the handful of hours since he'd killed Rook. A fundamental shift in the polarity of Genpop itself. Now the other inmates, including the gang members and even the guards, stayed away from him completely. Not so much out of fear or respect as self-preservation, the way a herd of non-sentient life forms will keep their distance from one carrying a lethal infection. It was as if they sensed what Maul had done and how he'd marked himself for death. Not that he cared. If it got him closer to Radik, nothing else mattered. Now he knelt before the image on the holoprojector, lowering his head before the face of his master.
My lord, I have continued to endeavor. Enough.
Sidious cut him off mid-sentence, his tone barbed with thorns of irritation.
Why do you continue to try my patience, my apprentice? Why do you persist in humiliating yourself while making me wait for answers that you should have provided days ago?
Maul narrowed his eyes in an attempt to see more clearly. Through the makeshift holoprojector, Sidious was staring down at him from what felt like miles above. Distant yet formidable. A weight that he could not lift. The question, apparently, was not rhetorical.
I am trying, Master. The path is difficult.
You dare to make excuses?
Sidious's voice roared in his head.
After the years I have spent training you, honing your skills, preparing you for every eventuality, training you in the ways of survival, endurance, and attack, how long have you begged for an opportunity to play some role in the grand plan?
And I am grateful,
Maul told him.
My loyalty to you is beyond question, pledged with my very life's blood.
Declarations of loyalty are worthless without victory.
Cruelty dripped from Sidious's words.
Abstractions do not interest me at this point. Time is short. Do you understand?
Yes, my master.
I wonder if you do, or if the time has come for me to find another apprentice more deserving of the honor.
Maul stiffened and rose.
No!
Then prove that you are worthy. Stop wasting my time with empty pledges of fidelity and complete the mission that you have been charged with.
Master, if I were only allowed to call upon the power of the dark side...
The thought snapped off unfinished. Maul felt an invisible hand clamp down over his throat, gripping the cartilage and cutting off the airway. Stumbling, he dropped back to his knees, to the coldness of the morgue floor.
You have been given everything you need and more. You enjoy untold physical advantages that these inferior combatants could only dream of. And you know very well the consequences of revealing your true abilities in the dark side, especially at this late stage. Many are watching. You are not the only one inside Coghive 7 searching for Radik.
Yes, my master.
Do not make me wait any longer. Find him now and make the appropriate arrangements.
Maul managed a single strangled nod of compliance, and at once the pressure disappeared. As suddenly as it had materialized, the hollow projector image flickered out, and the incorporeal vision of Sidious was gone, devoured by the void from which it had sprung. Maul fell to the floor and dropped his head, pressing his brow down against cold steel. Never had he experienced such urgency from the Dark Lord, such profound and overwhelming sense of purpose, driven by...
what?
Was there something else worrying his master, some danger to Lord Sidious himself that he had not shared with Maul? The idea made him uneasy, as it always did. He kept his head down, awaiting answers that would not come. He stayed that way for a long time, as the tension gathered in his core muscles, clenching his fists, tightening his jaw, drawing everything rigid. Red rage was already beginning to boil up from inside him. And, as always, he welcomed it, even as he drew clean breaths of air into his lungs. In the moments when everything else betrayed him, the rage was there, a lone companion. He lifted himself up and stood erect. His chest burned, his muscles ached, his head throbbed, and there was a low rattle in his lungs.
Master, I dedicate myself to you.
The hatchway slid open. Maul stepped through, and that was where they were waiting for him, just inside the open concourse. Caught utterly off guard, he scarcely had time to comprehend what was happening.
What?
A huge black and red explosion went off in front of his eyeballs, and he knew no more.
Whiteout.
Maul awoke to blinding lights. A blazing firestorm of incandescence that seared his eyes, obscuring whatever stood just behind them. He tried to move and discovered that he couldn't. His arms and legs were lashed and stretched spread-eagle, and he hung suspended in midair. Above
what?
It was impossible to say. What had they shot him with? Some kind of stun weapon, powerful enough to knock him completely unconscious. Whoever was responsible was clearly prepared to evade the surveillance cameras as well. It would explain the painfully intense lights, bright enough to mask whatever they were planning on doing to him. At length he heard a sound coming from off to his left, someone laboring to breathe. Incoherent words, croaking noises, the rasping harshness of respiratory distress. Maul was still listening to it, trying to process the details of his circumstances when he picked up the creak of approaching footsteps.
"Where's the old man?"
a voice asked.
"In the corner,"
a second, more familiar voice answered.
"Next to the bailer. Has he said anything significant?"
"He's delirious." The familiar voice was calm but not dispassionate, colored with an overtone of what might actually have been sympathy. "He contracted blood poisoning after he lost his leg. The infection's already spreading to his brain." From directly in front of him, the one who had spoken most recently leaned in close enough that Maul could make out his features.
"Hello, Jagannath."
Maul squinted up at the face of the Twi'lek above him.
"Zero?"
Zero gazed at him. "You've caused quite a stir around here," he said. "You really shouldn't have killed Rook. Mr. Radik was paying handsomely to keep him safe from being matched."
"So you do know him?"
"Sending the Nilvanian to hack into the algorithm was your first mistake." The Twi'lek's expression was slightly puzzled now, as if he couldn't quite figure out what had driven Maul to such a grave misstep.
"There have already been repercussions, you realize. Severe repercussions."
Reaching down, he hoisted a limp corpse and lifted it close enough that Maul could see it. It was Izmash. The Nelvanian's broken jaw hung slack on its hinges. His mouth and eye sockets were stuffed with scraps of broken circuit board and twisted wire, a message for whoever found the body. There was a faint, throat-clearing noise somewhere off to the left. Maul jerked his head up, struggling to pull himself free from the thick web of cables that lashed his arms and legs to walls that he couldn't see.
Is he here with you?
Maul asked.
Is Radik here?
Zero ignored the question. The guards and inmates will find your body next to the Nelvanians, he said with that same puzzled empathy. They'll know what happened. Such warnings must be sent from time to time. It is his will. Leaning in close enough that he could lower his voice, he spoke almost apologetically. No one threatens Mr. Radik, Jagannath. You understand, don't you? It's just business.
I have business with him.
Maul said,
Tell Radik.
Goodbye, Jagannath,
the other voice said. It was the first time that Maul had heard it.
It's a pity you have to end your time in Coghive 7 as a cautionary tale. You were an intriguing specimen while you lasted.
Wait!
Maul lifted his head again and caught sight of the figure next to Zero. It was a Weequay, one he'd never seen before. Or had he? The craggy, sun-baked face was raked back in a speculative frown, his high forehead crowned with a topknot. And Maul remembered the inmate that he'd seen on his first day here. The clawbird was perched on his shoulder.
Repercussions, Jagannath.
Without another word, the Weequay glanced at Zero, and the two of them turned and left the room. There was a jolting, mechanized clamor of heavy machinery being throttled reluctantly to life. Force feedback servos chugged and became a steady, pulsating drone. Maul thought of the factory floor. Before he could comprehend what that meant exactly, he felt the cables around his wrists and ankles beginning to draw tight, pulling him in four different directions. As suddenly as they'd appeared, the blinding lights went out, burying him in utter darkness. Maul jerked and yanked at his restraints, but the cables around his arms and legs only pulled tighter, stretching the sockets of his shoulders, cranking tension into hips and knees. He fought to pull himself free, but the restraints held fast. Something popped in his right wrist. Every joint began to burn. They were going to rip him to pieces. From above him, above the hum of the machinery, he heard a brisk flapping of wings. In the darkness, the wheezing noises began again. Labored words.
Going to kill us both,
a voice rasped. Now Maul recognized the voice. The old man was in here with him. Iagan's father, the one who'd lost his leg to Voistock's blaster. He searched his memory for the old man's name, and it came to him almost at once.
Aragorn.
Never should have saved his life,
the old man's voice said.
Should have stayed with the Bandal Gora. Too late now, I suppose.
Twisting his entire body as far as the cables would allow, Maul turned his head in the direction of the old man's voice. By now, the tension in his extremities had transcended pain, catapulting him into an entirely new realm of consciousness. Again, he thought, almost instinctively, of using the Force, of calling upon strength and ability whose magnitude could almost certainly save him from death. Surely such things had been placed at his disposal for a reason, a larger purpose, hadn't they? From the hinterlands of conscious thought, he heard his master's voice ringing out in his mind.
There are aspects of who we are,
Sidious had once told him,
that can only be revealed to us in the deepest pit of intolerable suffering, in those moments when all else is torn away. When we stand at the very brink of eternity itself and stare death in the face.
Maul didn't breathe. Sweat poured from his face. Still facing Artigan,
He managed to catch the old man's eye.
What did you say?
Bandogora, Artigan muttered. All hail the skull, Almar.
You are in the Bandogora.
We're going to kill Radik.
Somewhere in the darkness, the old man mumbled something else, an incoherent slur of consonants. Then he became lucid again.
I betrayed them, saved Radik from them. They've been hunting me down, ever since.
For a moment, Maul didn't speak. Beneath the pain and the rattling of the machine that was about to rip him to pieces, a new revelation had already begun taking shape in his mind.
That's why you brought your son here to Coghive 7.
The old man grunted in assent.
Radik swore he'd protect me.
Maul felt himself measuring what the old man said against whatever he knew to be true. The realization, a piece of the puzzle abruptly snapping into place, brought a sudden upsurge of determination. Summoning up all that remained of his strength, he wrenched his right arm as hard as he could away from the cable, dislocating his shoulder from its socket with an audible pop. A loopy, over-elasticized numbness spilled through the joint on a wave of pins and needles, threatening to render his entire arm useless. But the move brought just enough slack to the cable so that the binding slipped free around his right wrist. Jerking his arm loose, he reached across with a hand that was already rapidly going numb, fumbling with his left wrist. It seemed to take forever, but at last the left hand came free as well. Only after he'd gotten his ankles loose did he slam his upper torso against the floor, knocking the right shoulder back into place.
There!
He rose and crossed the room, his eyes fully acclimated to the darkness now. This was the factory floor, as he'd expected. The bulky machinery, Coil's bone sculptures hulking in the background, like an inevitable reminder of where they were all destined to end up. If Zero had brought him here, along with the Weak Way.
The Weak Way, he said aloud.
A half dozen steps later, he'd reached the spot where the old man lay on the floor, hideously diminished by his wounds, burning with fever. Maul could feel the heat radiating up from him like a blast furnace, could smell the sickness on him.
The one that was here with Zero. That's him, isn't it?
That's Iram Radik.
A foggy groan that might have been acknowledgement came from the old man.
Radik.
He managed.
I need to find him. What was his connection to the Gora?
Can't tell you.
Why not?
Only tell Egan.
Maul reached down and lifted Artigan Truax up, hoisting him over his shoulder.
What are you doing?
The old man asked.
Where are you taking me?
Out of here,
Maul said.
We've got things to discuss.
Rake and Fig.
Warden?
3D said.
They're ready for you.
Finishing her coffee, Siddiqui rose from behind her desk and directed her attention to the bank of holoscreens overhead. The monitor on the far right displayed the guards' ready room, where a group of Coghive 7's off-duty COs, 9 in all, were gathered around a long table. Some of the men stood silently or leaned against the wall. Others sat upright, nursing tumblers of Rancor aid, casting anxious glances at the hatchway. Even out of uniform, the men had a visible tension
that seemed to radiate from them in waves.
Warden?
The droid prompted.
I heard you.
Siddiqui said distractedly, not taking her eyes from the screen. She'd called the meeting 2 hours earlier, switching out the second shift duty roster at the last minute to ensure adequate coverage throughout the gallery and the cells.
Do me a favor and raise the temperature in there by 5 degrees.
May I ask why?
I'd like them to see them sweat a bit.
She turned back to the droid. Have you reached my brother yet?
Master Blur is not in his quarters, nor is he in the data center. In all honesty, I have no idea where he might have gone.
Keep trying.
She glanced at the chrono. We're only 2 hours away from the next match. I'd like his input on the combatants.
Combatants?
3D swiveled around to face her.
Respectfully, Warden, weren't we specifically ordered by Gaming Commissioner Chloris to suspend all bouts, pending...
Dakarai's algorithm has already made its selection, Siddiqui cut in.
And the last time I checked, current betting activity for this next match was already in the millions of credits.
Apparently the galaxy's casinos and high-stakes gamblers have already forgiven us for what happened.
But the Gaming Commission...
They can fine me.
Siddiqui raised her coffee cup and drained it.
As Dragomir himself said,
I've got more important things to worry about. An errant realization occurred to her, and she smiled.
And so does he, I think.
They could shut us down completely.
I doubt that very much,
a voice said from behind her. And Siddiqui turned to see Vesto Slipher striding into her office.
Slipher,
she said, not bothering to hide her surprise. How did you get in here?
As you know, the IBC enjoys yellow card access to the security codes within most of its subsidiaries,
the moon said mildly, raising one eyebrow.
Surely that's not a point of contention.
Not at all. I just assumed you were leaving us.
She put on a smile.
I'm pleased to see you've changed your mind.
Slipher pursed his lips with distaste. If it were up to me, he said, I would have left already. But my employer has asked me to stay on for a day or two while we get these complications with the Gaming Commission sorted out.
I appreciate their concern.
Believe me, Slipher said, it's not my idea. I don't understand it myself, and I'd hardly choose to remain in this cesspool a moment longer than necessary.
The moon nodded at her desk.
But you seem to have gotten Commissioner Chloris into quite an uproar. The IBC is simply protecting their investment in Coghive 7.
Of course.
Siddiqui looked across the bank of holoscreens, taking in the full sweep of Coghive 7, a view that she never found boring. The mess hall, the metal shop, the factory floor, all components of some infinite sociological experiment in galactic natural selection. Although she hadn't ventured down among the inmates themselves since the prison had opened, she recognized almost all their faces, and, in some cases, knew their daily routines better than they themselves did.
Now, she said, if you'll excuse me, I've got a meeting with the guards.
So I see.
Slipher looked at the screen, where he could see the guards loitering in the ready room.
Staffing problems?
Simple housekeeping issues, really.
Siddiqui tapped a command into the keypad at her desk, initiating remote access to the prison's data center. Glancing over her shoulder, Slipher watched the monitors as the digitized three-dimensional ray tracing of Coghive 7 took shape. Complex arrays of intersecting green and red lines rearranging themselves outside the officer's ready room. Seconds later, there was a distant lurching groan from beyond the walls of her office.
You're reconfiguring the prison now?
The moon asked.
but the next bout isn't scheduled to start for 2 hours. Simply changing some details around, Siddiqui said. It's one of the benefits of our station's modular structure. There's really nothing that can't be rearranged. I see. I'm going down to the ready room. She turned to the droid. Keep an eye out for my brother.
Of course.
On second thought, she paused to consider. Perhaps you'd better join me after all, just to be safe.
As you prefer.
Without another glance at the screens or the moon, Siddiqui left the office and went down to meet the men.
Hooligans.
When the back panel of his cell slid open, Vass Nailhead assumed that he was dreaming. Unlike most of the inmates here, Nailhead spent a good deal of his time alone in his cell. After a lifetime in various prisons around the galaxy, he had no real interest in mingling with the rest of the inmates. As purported head of the Bone Kings, he still continued his reign of terror. But with the Zabrak, Jagannath in charge of both gangs now, Nailhead's title had become largely symbolic. Nothing excited him anymore. He still ate flesh, but he didn't enjoy it like he used to. These days, he spent most of his day brooding over fan mail and endorsement offers or lapsing in and out of shallow, unsatisfying sleep. More and more, he found himself thinking of his home planet, his family, the offspring he'd left behind. His fellow Bone Kings still swore an oath of loyalty to him, but secretly, Nailhead wished that the algorithm would pit him against one of them, just to change things up. He dreamed of leaving here. But like every inmate, he knew the only way out was through the floorboards. He dreamed of the worm. This time, when the prison had started shifting around him with the familiar rumble and clang of reconfiguration, Nailhead simply assumed that he drowsed through the clarion call and that the next fight was about to begin. It had happened from time to time. He lifted his head and glanced around, wondering, not quite idly, if he might be selected for a match, perhaps against Jagannath himself, in a battle that, if Nailhead won, might restore some of the excitement and glory to his life. But as consciousness cycled back to him, he realized that the door of his cell was still open, and there was none of the usual clamor of inmates returning to lockdown. So what was happening? That was when the panel slid open behind him.
Nailhead,
a voice said. Vass Nailhead stared at the Nogri stepping into his cell. It was Strabo, his sworn enemy, who until very recently had been head of the Gravity Massive. Yet here he was, standing in front of Nailhead with a glint of bemused disbelief, as if Strabo himself couldn't quite believe he'd come here.
What's this about?
Nailhead growled. Strabo said nothing. And then Nailhead saw them, the other inmates, gathered behind the Nogri, a ragtag mixture of Bone Kings and Gravity Massive members standing side by side. The Massives were armed with their cable darts and melee weapons. The Kings were all carrying bones, sharpened and studded with metal tips and straps, specialized modifications that they'd added.
Somebody let us out,
Strabo said.
What?
Reconfigured our cells. Opened up a back passageway for us.
Why?
Who knows?
Strabo shrugged.
All I know is things used to be different around here. Maybe not great, but at least they made sense. You know what I mean? Before that red-skinned freak came in and changed everything.
Uh-huh.
Nailhead found himself nodding.
Back when we were in charge.
He ruminated and glanced up at Strabo.
So you think...
Maybe this individual, whoever it is, opened the walls for us. Maybe because they want a certain situation taken care of.
You got a plan?
I've got a weapon.
Strabo nodded at the open hatchway from which he and the others had just emerged.
What if we follow the passageway? See where it takes us.
Yeah?
There's worse ways to spend a few hours,
Strabo said. And reaching out, he tossed a sharpened femur bone to Nailhead, who plucked it handily from the air, though he still had no idea what was going on.
So, what do you say? Care for a walkabout?
Yeah.
Standing up, placing his hands on his hips, and stretching his back, Nailhead grinned back at him.
I guess maybe I do.
Side by side, the two gang leaders headed back through the hatchway with the others following behind them into the walls of the prison.
Ready Room. Ready Room.
The fat CEO's name was Hootkins, and Smite could already smell him starting to sweat.
Well?
He asked.
What's the deal?
Hootkins didn't say anything, just slammed the half-liter tumbler of Rancor Aid that he'd been nursing and pressed one meaty hand to the wall behind him. Smite felt himself twitching with impatience. It was getting unpleasantly hot in the ready room among all these bodies pressed in around him. And what had the warden summoned them all together for anyway? He waited, bouncing on his heels, as Hootkins glanced at the guard standing to his right, a pumped-up glandular catastrophe named Logovic. Smite knew almost all the names of the guys on his shift. Steubens, Merrill, Glant. But he was still learning the rest of the roster. Not that it mattered much. None of these old-timers would give him the time of day. Not yet. When the warden had summoned them all to the ready room on short notice, no uniforms or weapons necessary, Smite had snorted another half-gram of glitter stim from his private stash before hitting the deck. He'd already discovered that the stim gave him confidence and a telepathic boost that made everything feel heightened and somehow more vibrant at the same time. As if zing! An invisible saber had been drawn from its scabbard straight up his nose. Not to mention the courage that it gave him for certain unauthorized aspects of the job, going face to face with that red-skinned inmate 11240 in his cell, for example, or the mission they'd just undertaken down on the factory floor. It had made him feel like the king of the galaxy. The truth was, Smite loved the spice. Smuggling his stash into Coghive 7 had been a lot easier than he'd expected. And he'd even managed to sell a little to a couple of the other COs. Making friends had always come easy to him that way. Too bad he hadn't had a chance to offer some to Hootkins. Who knew, he thought. Maybe the porky loser could use some as a diet aid.
So,
Smite asked, drumming his fingers against the table in front of him.
What's the problem?
One of the side effects of the stim was that it made you restless, ready to move ahead while everything else dragged behind.
You guys don't actually think... Shut up!
Hootkins snapped without bothering to glance at him. Now the fat man had one ear pressed to the wall of the ready room. Listening for a long moment, he turned back to Logovic.
Yeah,
he said. It's on. It's not big, but it's happening.
What's on? Smite asked. What's happening?
Warden's reconfiguring.
What, now?
Smite checked his chrono.
But we don't have another fight scheduled till...
The main hatchway of the ready room whirred open, and Warden Blur stepped inside, followed in short order by her administrative droid. She stopped there, looked coolly across their faces, and smiled.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I want to thank you for coming on such short notice.
The guard straightened up. Logovic muttered a grunt of acknowledgement, and a few others offered unenthusiastic greetings in response. Among the men, Siddiqui Blur wasn't particularly popular. Apparently some of the guys actually found her attractive, but Smite was indifferent to that aspect of her. Fact was, the spice had more or less switched off that part of his mind, at least for the moment, and he was grateful. In a place like this, he decided, the fewer the distractions, the better.
I'm sure you're all wondering why you're here, Siddiqui said, so I won't waste your time.
She turned and faced the droid. 3D, is my call patched through?
Yes, Warden.
Okay, go ahead. She gestured to the group of guards gathered on the far side of the room.
If you men wouldn't mind stepping to either side, I have a feeling that we're going to need all the space we can get.
As they shuffled out of the way, leaving an entire corner clear, the droid's holoprojector flickered to life. For a moment, Smite wasn't sure whether what he was seeing was real or a side effect of the stim. 8 meters in front of him, the mountainous shape of his employer had already come into focus to fill the entire corner of the ready room. Smite gaped as Jabba Dacilogic Tiur shifted his enormous tail, gazing out at the audience that awaited him.
Hello, Jabba, Siddiqui said. I appreciate you making time in your busy schedule for me.
Siddiqui Blur.
The crime lord's mouth opened just enough for him to run his tongue along his upper lip with a lascivious sneer.
You know, if you ever get tired of running that prison, I would be happy to make you one of my slave girls.
Such a generous offer.
She remained absolutely composed, even congenial before him.
Unfortunately, I'll have to decline for now.
To what do I owe the honor?
Ah, well. Siddiqui gestured at the guards who had come to abrupt attention behind her, including Smite himself.
I believe I have some of your people here.
What the Fever Said.
Egan had been doing pull-ups on the uppermost bar of his cell when the walls began to move. His initial panicked thought was that he was about to be matched, that death had come for him even sooner than he'd feared.
Please, no, I'm not ready. Not yet. Not ever.
When the reconfiguration stopped and nothing happened, Egan felt a wild surge of relief, followed immediately by a sense of shame so overpowering that it drove him to the floor of the cell, where he lay motionless, hating himself for his cowardice. What would his father have thought of him, head down, praying to whatever gods might be listening that he would not have to fight, not now, not ever? Egan. He jerked his head up at the sound of the haggard voice and looked around to see Jagannath standing there. The Zabrak was holding something in his arms like a bundle of laundry. It took a moment for Egan to realize that the bundle was a man, and that the man was in fact his father.
Father!
His gaze flew up to the Zabrak, hot and accusatory.
What did you do to him?
I did nothing, boy,
Jagannath said. I found him like this.
Again.
Artagan Truax gazed at his son through dazed and bleary eyes. His skin had gone the color of old flimsoplast, the flesh so pale that the blue tracery of his veins was clearly visible in his cheeks and on the bridge of his nose. Egan regarded the swollen stump where the old man's leg had been, sensed the fever radiating out of his father's face and the foul smell of infected tissue, and knew what it all meant, before the Zabrak could say the words.
He's dying.
Jagannath nodded.
He contracted blood poisoning from the wound.
Lowering Artagan Truax to the bunk, he said,
He won't talk to me. You need to question him. About Iram Radik and the Bando Gora.
Egan shook his head.
I don't know what that...
Listen to me, boy. There's no time for excuses. I saw Iram Radik. I need to know anything else your father can tell us about Radik's relationship with the Bando Gora. They are the ones who are going to take possession of Radik's most destructive weapon, a prescribed nuclear device. This is my mission.
But I've never heard of the Bando.
It's a death cult. Your father told me that he used to fight alongside them, that they tried to kill Iram Radik, and he saved Radik's life.
My father would never join a cult, Egan said. He doesn't know what he's...
Gora!
The old man shrieked, his face twisting into a mask of terror. His hands flew up to hook and claw the air.
All hail the skull beneath the hood! Flay the skin and drink the blood!
Egan took a startled step back.
I've never heard him talk like this before.
I need to know what he knows,
Jagannath said.
I have urgent business to transact between them and Iram Radik. If he can tell you anything about how to contact them...
No!
All at once the old man lunged upright, seizing his son by the shoulder and pulling him close. Sudden clarity had descended over his face, and his pupils sharpened, fixating on Egan.
Iram Radik will never do business with the Gora. Never!
Ask him how to reach the Gora, the Zabrak said to Egan. Ask him how we can contact them. Get him to talk.
I'll do what I can, Egan said. But there's another match coming. What if I have to fight?
The Zabrak glared at him.
You'll die.
Egan opened his mouth and closed it again. There seemed to be no reasonable response to the words, and he didn't attempt one.
Everything here, the Zabrak said. Everything you see around you is a test. Make no mistake. If you lack the strength or ability to survive, the hive will break you.
He stepped closer to Egan.
At his core, your father was strong enough to survive and protect you. But you don't have his heart. Even the way he is now, in this wasted state, you'll never be half the man that he is.
He jerked his head at the old man, groaning and muttering to himself on the bunk.
Now make yourself useful and get him to talk.
Egan said nothing. His jaw trembled.
Father, it's me. It's Egan.
Glancing back up at the Zabrak, he said gently,
We need to know about Iram Radik.
The old man's eyes fluttered and closed. All strength fled from him and his mouth fell open, his face going slack. For a terrible instant, Egan thought he died. Then he saw the chest rise and fall, a shallow and halting breath, but a breath just the same, followed by a few brief, barely coherent words.
What was that?
Jagannath stared at Egan.
What did he say?
He said Zero.
Zero? What about him?
Egan frowned up at the Zabrak. He said...
The boy glanced down at his father, then back up at Jagannath, blinking in confusion.
He answers to another name.
Bestiary.
Smite began to inch backward and realized that he was already pressed up against the wall. He wasn't sure exactly when his heart had started pounding, but now it felt ready to explode. Rivulets of sweat trickled from between his shoulder blades and crept down the center of his spine, plastering his damp shirt against his skin, and he forced himself to take a low, shuddering breath.
Stay cool. They won't see anything that you don't show them.
Hoping to disappear between the guards on either side of him, he realized there was nowhere else to go.
Just breathe.
So, Jabba, Siddiqui was saying from the front of the group. I keep hearing rumors of you sending foot soldiers into my prison to work as guards. I'm hoping you can clear that up for me. Waving her hand toward the 9 guards in the ready room, she said, Do any of these men look familiar? Smite didn't breathe. None of the guards around him moved. On the holovid, the hut reclined, his slitted eyes moving languidly back and forth, taking in the room. At length, he let out a slow, guttural laugh. The mocking ho-ho-ho that Smite had come to identify with a particularly unpleasant frozen sensation through his bowels. He had only heard that laugh once before, and it had been one time too many.
You are wasting my time, Warden.
Jabba said, answering in the guttural Huttese that Smite's ear translated effortlessly into Basic.
I recognize none of these swine.
Are you certain? Siddiqui asked. Because I'll be happy to return any of your own men to you unharmed in the spirit of maintaining peace with the Dasilajic clan. A slight frown line formed over her forehead. The ones you don't claim... Well... She glanced at 3D. Let's just say they're slightly more disposable.
Kill them all and toss their carcasses to swamp slugs. It is all the same to me.
I see. Well, perhaps I should ask the men. She pushed a button on the wall. Smite heard a faint whirring sound to his right and glanced over his shoulder. Across the ready room, directly opposite the hollow projection of Jabba, an oblong panel slid open to expose a recessed area that had not been there just a moment before. A result, he guessed, of this last reconfiguration. From this angle, Smite could not see inside it, but he had the sudden realization that whatever was back there had already started to move out. Gentlemen, Siddiqui said, I'm sure you all know Mr. Nailhead and Mr. Strabo. A thin blade of silence sliced through the ready room. Then Nailhead and Strabo stepped into view, and Smite heard the other guards drawing back with sharp curses and sounds of disbelief, cramming into whatever space they could find, reaching instinctively for weapons and drop boxes that weren't there.
Wait a second,
Hoots called out, somewhere off to Smite's left. The fat guard's suety voice, now high-pitched with fear and panic.
Warden, what is this? What are you doing?
Smite, for his part, could not move. He felt his whole body go strangely weightless. All at once, his legs seemed to have disappeared. The same paralysis seized his chest, and he realized that he was physically incapable of drawing breath. Siddiqui just smiled. It's a simple question. she said, stepping forward to fill the space between the Bone Kings and the guards. Any of you working for the Silagic clan, please step forward. She gazed at the guards. No one? Are you sure?
Me!
Lodovic shouted from off to Smite's left and jumped forward, practically knocking down the men on either side of him.
Jabba sent us here to track down Iram Radik!
Ah, Siddiqui said. And what were your orders exactly?
Jabba told us to find out everything we could, to ferret him out and drive him into the open.
Is there anyone else in this room that you would care to identify?
Crete! He's part of it!
Logovic shouted, pointing at a tall, gray-haired guard on the other side of the room. All at once, he couldn't seem to get the names out fast enough.
And Galway! Tyson! Oliphant! McCain! Over there, Weberly! And...
His hand swung around toward Smite.
That new guy, the rookie. I don't know his name. Jabba sent him in, too. He forged the background check for all of us and told us we had to...
Scum!
From the hollow, Jabba's lazy smile had disappeared, overwhelmed by a vicious sneer of disgust.
You just signed your death warrant.
If Logovic even heard the hut, he ignored him. His eyes flashed desperately from the Bone Kings back to Siddiqui.
That's it! That's all of us!
Can I go now? Siddiqui gazed at him pityingly. I'm sorry, Officer... Logovic, is it? She gave a slow, sad shake of her head. But I'm afraid your employer is right about one thing. I couldn't possibly let you go now. And gentlemen... She glanced back at Strabo, Nailhead, and the amalgamation of gang members, Bone Kings and Massives alike, that they'd led here. Whatever happens next, you and your gang would do well to remember that the only drop box in the room is strapped to my hip.
Away!
Logovic managed. All the remaining color had drained out of his face, leaving it sickly and pale.
But...
Best of luck, gentlemen. And I thank you for your candor. Siddiqui stepped back, clearing the way for the Bone Kings. For an instant there was silence. And within that split second, Smite heard it. A low, snarling chuckle. It was Nailhead. Then it happened. It might have been the glitter stim, but Smite experienced the events of the next few seconds in what felt like sickening slow motion. As one, the gang members burst forward across the ready room with a deafening howl, overturning chairs and leaping across the table, attacking the guards in a solid wave. Smite was knocked to the side and the table landed on top of him, temporarily blocking him from view, although he could still catch a glimpse over the top of it with agonizing clarity. In the space between seconds, the entire room had already exploded in a mass of activity, swinging bones, flashing teeth, and crashing fists. All around him, the guards tried to scatter, but there was nowhere to go. The gang member's angle of attack had blocked the only possible path to the chamber's main entryway, and they piled on top of the guards, overwhelming them easily. Pressed between the overturned table and the wall, Smite dropped to his knees and then to his stomach, as if there might be some way that he could crawl across the floor and find his way out without being detected. He already felt his grasp on reality skidding, slipping perilously away. All around him, guys he'd come to know on a first-name basis were screaming, squirming in every direction, scrambling for a way out. From this angle, he could see Hootkins trying to jump over him, the fat man shoving belly first, fighting desperately to plow a path between two of the Bone Kings, making a last-ditch run for the exit.
His face was a blur of terror. After two steps, Hootkin stumbled and lost his balance, and two of the kings grabbed him and slammed him to the floor, impaling him with sharpened ribs that they'd lashed to their wrists like claws and ripping him to pieces.
Goodbye, Hootkins.
Smite kept staring. He seemed unable to look away. Right in front of him, a threesome of massives and bone kings had gone to work on two other guards, Crete and a bald, broad-shouldered guy who might have been Weberly. From here it was impossible to say. Another one of the gang members had McCain up against the wall, tearing open McCain's shirt and using a broken skull to scoop out his thoracic cavity, while Nailhead and his lieutenant, an animal named Massif, were holding on to the hands and feet of Oliphant, literally ripping him in two, bathing in his blood.
Goodbye, Oliphant.
Smite felt a kind of queer, fatalistic certainty take hold of him. If he stayed here another 30 seconds, the gang members would run out of guards to destroy and would find him. He couldn't stay here. He sat up. The chair hit the wall just above his head, splintering to pieces. Logovic, the guard who had ratted them all out, the one who had brought all of us down on them, swung an arm down and picked up one of the chair fragments, jerking it up over his head like a makeshift weapon. Seeing him here spiked a sudden upsurge of anger into Smite's brain, and in stark defiance of the fear he felt in his own chest, he grabbed Logovic by the ankle.
Happy!
He shouted.
You did this to us! You got what you deserve, maggot!
Logovic swung his elbow back, hammering Smite to the side of the face, and Smite's eyes exploded in a supernova of bright white stars. When his vision cleared, he heard the unmistakable sound of Vast Nailhead unleashing a war howl. The inmate raising the sharpened femur gripped in